You have just 20 seconds comment on this.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to comment specifically for New York. Governor Cuomo has complete discretion to be able to issue mass clemencies for the prisons. We know that de Blasio, the mayor, has the power to be able to release hundreds and thousands of people from Rikers Island and other jails. And so we really want them to be able to do that. There's lots of pressure and demands that have been issued by local groups.
We're going to leave it there, but I want to thank you both for being with us. Maren Caba, organizer, abolitionist, founder of Project NEA, and Dean Spade, associate professor at Seattle University School of Law, founder of the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, creator of mutual aid resource website, BigDoorBrigade.com. I want to just take this moment to thank the remarkable team of family, my co-workers at Democracy Now, who are mainly working from home. I want to thank Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Dennis Moynihan, Adriana Contreras, Marie Tarasena.
And you are tuned in to KBOO Portland. The time is 8 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220 HR Hood River. Coming up next is Sojourner Truth. And then after that is going to be a show from the Mayo Clinic, which will be talking about some updates about COVID-19. And then at 10 o'clock, it's Radio Zine. Then at 10:30, it's Film at 11. Then at 11, it's Pacific Underground. So stay tuned, because all of your favorite cable programming is coming up throughout the day. We thank you for tuning in. Hope you're having a good morning. Hope you're washing your hands and doing all the things that people are asking. And hope you're not going too stir crazy if you are someone who's having to stay inside the house, hoping that it is, an experience. We'll just put that. Everyone's having an experience right now. And if you are feeling a little cabin fever, well, know you're in a boat with many, many others. So yeah, let's be all in a radio community together and know that we're at least listening together. So thank you so much for tuning in this morning.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth, exclusively on Pacifica Radio and its affiliate stations. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, mothers and grandmothers spearhead a movement that is successful at bringing to justice generals who implemented Argentina's dirty wars. The controversial discussion on trafficking in women. Who's being protected? Who is being persecuted and driven further underground? What is the relationship between between criminalization and vulnerability to violence. Also, Canada, New Zealand, the U.S. and the U.K., the movement to decriminalize sex work. Where is the debate in the women's movement? Why is the Swedish model not the answer? We have a far-ranging discussion with women's rights activist Nina Lopez. She hails from Argentina and is now based in London, England. She is with Legal Action for Women and the English Collective of Prostitutes. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headline.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Trump railed behind closed doors about House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's decision to delay sending articles of impeachment to the Republican-controlled Senate, putting an expected trial in limbo. Senator Lindsey Graham, a staunch Trump GOP ally, emerged from a White House meeting with the president with a message. Graham told Fox News, quote, he's demanding his day in court. Trump has seen a Senate trial as his means for vindication, viewing acquittal as a partial antidote to impeachment's stain on his legacy. But that effort has been threatened by Pelosi's decision to delay sending the articles approved by the House Wednesday to the Senate until, she says, Republican leaders offer more details about how they'll handle an expected trial. California Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell told CNN that Pelosi's decision makes sense.
The Speaker and the American people should have assurances that there's going to be a fair trial and that the outcome's not going to be rigged. And I think that's also something that we owe to the witnesses who risked their livelihood, their careers, their lives to come forward and describe what the president did to abuse his office.
Democrats have asked to include witnesses in the trial that declined to appear during House committee hearings, including acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney and former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Senate Leader Mitch McConnell has rejected that and has said he'll coordinate his trial proceedings with the White House. Democratic presidential candidates clashed on a range of issues in their final debate of 2019 last night in Los Angeles. The issues of health care, climate change, the economy were all discussed, but things got a little testy over the issue of money and politics. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren went after South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg for attending an exclusive Napa Valley fundraiser with rich donors.
Billionaires in wine caves should not pick the next president of the United States.
But Buttigieg clapped back.
Senator, your presidential campaign right now, as we speak, is funded in part by money you transferred, having raised it at those exact same big-ticket fundraisers you now denounce.
Impeachment also loomed large, with each of the candidates promising to restore the integrity of the presidency from what they called the corruption of President Trump. The U.S. is closely watching North Korea for signs of a possible missile launch or nuclear test in the coming days that officials are referring to as a Christmas surprise. A substantial launch or test could signal a decision by Pyongyang to end its self-imposed moratorium on nuclear and long-range missile tests. That would deal a significant blow to one of the Trump administration's major foreign policy initiatives, the drive to get North Korea back to negotiations on ending its nuclear weapons program. North Korea had accused Washington of trying to force a nuclear agreement without offering Pyongyang any concessions on economic sanctions. Two volunteer firefighters died Thursday while battling wildfires ravaging the Australian state of New South Wales. The blazes have forced Prime Minister Scott Morrison to cut short his family holiday as authorities braced for temperatures to soar in New South Wales over the weekend. The firefighters were in a truck convoy fighting blazes southwest of Sydney when a tree fell and caused the vehicle to roll off the road. The two men, both fathers of infant children, died at the scene, while three other firefighters were injured and taken to a hospital and are reportedly in stable condition. California Attorney General Javier Becerra and other top Democrats are appealing to the Supreme Court a federal appellate court ruling this week that ruled Obamacare's individual mandate is unconstitutional. Christopher Martinez reports.
At issue was a 2018 ruling from Texas Federal Trial Court Judge Reed O'Connor that said Obamacare is invalid because Congress eliminated a tax on uninsured people, an issue known as the individual mandate. That mandate was already toothless because Congress eliminated the tax in 2017. A federal appeals court for the 5th District in Louisiana said the law.
All right, everyone. For those of you who have called in and said, hey, that's an older episode of Sojourner Truth, you're right. So, right now, because that's the file they sent us, we're going to try to figure this one out real quick, and hopefully we'll see. Maybe they are like us, and they're having a hard time recording their shows right now, and they are rebroadcasting stuff. So we're going to go with the, hey, let's have a little technical difficulty moment, because that seems to be the definition of life right now. A little bit of technical difficulties. We'll be back, and I'm hoping in just about 30 seconds. So hold on there, and hopefully we can check in with KPFA and see what's going on with Sojourner Truth. That's that technical difficulties music. Was that 30 seconds? Maybe a little bit less than 30 seconds. I don't know. We'll see. But we just want to thank Sojourner Truth for helping us out with getting the correct episode. So here we go. We're getting a little bit started a little bit later. We're going to do a little bit of a restart. But hey, everyone, that's what we're doing these days. A lot of restarting and trying to figure things out. So thank you so much for tuning in. Here is the correct Sojourner Truth for today. Keep your room.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
What are the specific dangers of the coronavirus to Black and brown people? How does one's racial background impact your access to health care? Our guests are Dr. Chandra Ford, founding director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health at UCLA, and Dr. Bita Amani, associate professor at Charles R. Drew University. Also, are election security issues now compounded by the coronavirus? We speak with John Bonifaz, co-founder and president of Free Speech for People. For our weekly Earth Watch, attempts to criminalize climate protesters, we speak with Lauren Regan, executive director overseeing the Civil Liberties Defense Center. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. The Senate has approved a $100 billion plus bill to boost testing for the coronavirus and guarantee paid sick leave for some of the tens of millions of workers who are losing jobs or wages. President Trump quickly signed it. By the time the measure became law, the White House and lawmakers had already turned their focus to the administration's far bigger $1 trillion plan to stabilize the economy as the pandemic threatens financial ruin for individuals and businesses. Details on the plan remain sparse, Its centerpiece is to dedicate $500 billion to start issuing direct payments to U.S. citizens only by early next month. That would leave out millions of non-citizen immigrants, many of whom are low-wage workers. It would also funnel cash to businesses to help keep workers on payroll, as widespread sectors of the U.S. economy are all but shutting down. In a memo, the Treasury Department proposed two $250 billion cash infusions to individuals, a first set of checks issued starting April 6th with a second wave in mid-May. The amounts would depend on income and family size. The Treasury plan requires approval by Congress. It also recommends $50 billion to the airlines, $150 billion to issue loan guarantees to other struggling sectors, $300 billion for small businesses. Taken together, the administration plan promises half of the $1 trillion to families and individuals. Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi issued a statement late in the day saying her priorities include expanding eligibility for unemployment insurance and aid to small businesses that ensures workers will be paid. Democrats are also sure to seek aid to states whose budgets are falling out of balance. Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin said the government should not just give people a one-time cash payment.
Some have suggested cash payments to individual Americans. I have no aversion to that idea, but I hope it is substantial, and I hope it isn't a one-time helping hand that isn't followed up. Many of us on the Democratic side are working on a program that we think will say to families, we're not just going to send you one check and wish you the best. We're going to stand by you through this very difficult and challenging time.
Democratic presidential candidate Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders floated his own ideas. They include having the federal government keep paying employees' paychecks and having Medicare cover unmet health care needs stemming from the coronavirus outbreak. He snapped at a CNN reporter who asked him about dropping out of the presidential race. Sanders said he's dealing with an effing global crisis. President Trump has announced he's invoking a federal law that allows the government to force private industry to produce, in this case, medical equipment and supplies that are scarce as health officials confront a potential onslaught of coronavirus patients.
We'll be invoking the Defense Production Act just in case we need it. In other words, I think you all know what it is, and it can do a lot of good things if we need it.
Trump said he will expand the nation's testing capacity and deploy one Navy hospital ship to New York City, which has a large and rising number of coronavirus cases. A second ship will be deployed to the West Coast. Not clear if that will be off the coast of California or Washington. Trump also defended his calling the coronavirus the Chinese virus, despite the racist implications and the danger it poses to Asian Americans being scapegoated. A reporter asked Trump about that terminology.
Okay, why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus? There are reports of dozens of incidents of bias against Chinese Americans in this country. Your own aide, Secretary Azar, says he does not use this term. He says ethnicity does not cause the virus. Why do you keep using this?
A lot of
people
comes
say
from
it's
China.
Racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
The Chinese city where the coronavirus first took hold reported no new local cases. The death toll in Italy is poised to overtake that of China in a dramatic illustration of how the outbreak has pivoted toward Europe and the United States. Italy, a country of 60 million, registered 2,978 deaths yesterday after another 475 people died. Italy has been averaging more than 350 deaths a day. It's likely to overtake China's deaths, 3,249, in a country of 1.4 billion. United Nations and Italian health authorities cite a variety of reasons for the toll, key among them Italy's large elderly population. Italy has the world's second oldest population after Japan's. Two members of Congress announced they had tested positive, Florida Republican Mario Diaz-Balart and Utah Democrat Ben McAdams. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott. We are now going to go directly to our weekly Earth Watch. There are attempts in the United States, but also in the UK, to specifically criminalize climate protesters. Let us go to a clip now related to Extinction Rebellion in the UK. This clip is from The Telegraph.
This is an immense victory for the right to assembly and protest, which are cornerstones of democracy. It's time to act, not to outlaw the alarm, but to listen to it and to tackle the climate emergency with the urgency that it deserves.
Rather than silencing and criminalizing Extinction Rebellion's activists, we call on the government to tell the truth and act now on this climate and ecological emergency.
What do we want?
Climate justice!
What do we want?
Now!
Woo!
And that clearly was a victory for Extinction Rebellion in the UK. I'd now like to welcome our guest, Lauren Regan, Executive Director, oversees the Civil Liberties Defense Center as its founder and senior staff attorney. She has extensive federal and state litigation experience in both civil rights and activist defense cases, as well as expertise in necessity and other constitutional defenses. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so Lauren, it seems as though we're seeing a whole spate of attempts to criminalize climate protesters. We've seen that in terms of the protests against the pipelines in Canada very recently, also in the United States and in the UK. So give us your perspective on what is happening. That clip clearly showed a victory in London, England, I think, for Extinction Rebellion. Lauren.
Well, I think that state repression against dissenters is nothing new. We've seen that, you know, for many, many environmental and social justice movements over the years, whether that is criminalizing through legislation, whether it's surveillance and disruption by spies or law enforcement, or whether it is putting people in prison for long time periods as a result of their actions. But regardless of these types of repression and these waves of persecution, activists who strongly believe in their cause know that at the time that they're engaging in these actions, that they risk arrest and that they potentially risk state punishment, and they do it anyway. And it's our job to try to figure out ways to navigate the legal system in a way that reflects what we think is the growing and majority consciousness of people in the U.S. And so the necessity defense, or the choice of evils defense, is a way for a jury of your peers to be able to be that conscience of the community. The court gives them a jury instruction that basically allows them to balance the threat and the harm that is caused by, in this instance, climate change versus the harm that is caused by economic disruption, you know, by mere trespass or by blocking train lines, as in the case of this Extinction Rebellion case. And part of the test that they have to measure is whether or not that harm is serious and imminent, and whether the defendant's actions in any way address or mitigate that harm. And so for a long time, we've been trying to use the climate necessity defense for these types of actions, and the courts have been denying us access to the jury, saying that climate change was not imminent enough. But I think now, with the overwhelming science and just the fact that it's in people's face on a day-to-day basis at this point, even in the U.S., the courts are no longer able to play that gatekeeper role in keeping the necessity defense out of the courtroom. And so more and more, we have been able to actually put climate experts, law and policy experts, experts on the efficacy of civil disobedience or economic disruption, and, you know, as well as have our clients take the stand and talk about what caused normal people to get to the point of being willing to risk their liberty and go to jail in order to try to draw attention to, you know, this existential catastrophic threat of climate change. And in the Extinction Rebellion case, we put on a bunch of experts, we put on testimony, we gave them as much information as we could in the courtroom. The judge then read them the choice of evils jury instruction. They deliberated for about a day and a half. It was the first time that a jury in the U.S. had been allowed to have all of this evidence and the jury instruction. And after a day and a half, 5 out of 6 jurors came back and voted to acquit the defendants of the charge. That resulted in, you know, what is called a hung jury or a mistrial, where the state has the discretion to either re-prosecute the defendants or not. And just a couple weeks ago, the state of Oregon made the decision not to re-prosecute, dismissed all of their charges, and the case is now a full-blown victory as well.
Right. Well, it's really good to see some victories happening, because certainly we have been very worried after the Dakota Access pipeline, those protests that happened and attempts to criminalize those protesters, attempts to refer to the Black Lives Matter protesters as terrorists, for example. So it's good to know that there are some victories along the way. Also recently in Canada, we saw some arrests happening there as Indigenous people protesting incursions on their lands for a pipeline project. But another victory, just to mention that a court in Arizona acquitted Scott Warren, who was a volunteer. He was charged with quote-unquote harboring 2 migrants after he provided them with food, water, and a place to sleep. And the federal judge reversed the conviction of 4 other humanitarian volunteers on similar charges in February. So we'll see how this goes. And of course, now with the whole world occupied with a pandemic, one has to wonder, you know, how much governments are going to move forward with, you know, trying to criminalize protesters. And plus, people are not gathering right now anyway. But Lauren, for people who want to find out more about these cases and about the work that you are involved in, what should they do?
Well, I would suggest that they go to our website, which is cldc.org, the Civil Liberties Defense Center.org, and to speak to the point you just raised about, you know, sort of activism being in a little bit of a hibernation period right now. One of the things that we are starting to do, starting next week, is a series of webinars that are basically, you know, mini trainings of the interface between law and activism. So we've got Know Your Rights for Activists, for Youth, State Repression, how to use FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, how to work with lawyers, a bunch of skill building in this time period where we can't necessarily be out on the streets together.
Right. Well, that's I'm really glad you mentioned that, because I know a lot of people are moving on to doing webinars right now. Would you be able to please send us information on that series so we can post it on our social media and people who may want to join the webinars?
Absolutely.
Is that possible?
You know, we also want to acknowledge that not everybody has good access to the internet or to this kind of technology. So, you know, this isn't an ideal situation, but it's trying to make the best out of a bad situation.
Right. Well, on that note, we are going to have to leave it there. Lauren Regan, thank you so very much for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
And we also want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. Of course, we partner with them for our weekly Earth Minute as well as our weekly Earth Watch. We are now going to turn our attention to the coronavirus. Specifically, as the coronavirus pandemic continues to impact states as well as around the world, there are concerns about how it will devastate vulnerable communities across the country. And among these vulnerable communities are people of color, are Black and brown people.
According to the Health Affairs Journal, people of color face higher rates of diabetes, obesity, stroke, heart disease, and cancer than their white counterparts. Furthermore, black and Latino people have the highest rate of asthma cases and deaths in the United States. They also have the highest number of emergency room visits and hospital stays due to asthma. According to new information from the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, asthma is among the conditions that appear to make people more vulnerable to the severe form of coronavirus. In addition to experiencing higher levels of chronic illness, poverty wages and inadequate insurance coverage among communities of color greatly limit access to treatment, forcing many to work while sick. While the incomes of most people in the United States have gone down over the past decade, black and brown people have been disproportionately represented within lower income levels. There is a growing wealth gap between racially and ethnically diverse households compared to white households, which greatly affects access to health care. According to Blood Advances Medical Journal, the total monthly medical cost for the white population averaged a little over $10,143 versus $11,546 for black patients, and even higher for Latino patients, $12,657. And according to a 2017 RAND Health study, people in the United States with just one or two chronic illnesses in 2014 paid double the out-of-pocket costs compared to people without chronic conditions. A majority of those reported to have chronic illnesses are, you guessed it, people of color. There's a long history of racism in the United States healthcare system, which continues to impact communities of color today. We'll be talking a bit more about that, but first, I would like to go to a clip from News 19 in South Carolina about asthma and coronavirus.
While doctors are still learning more about COVID-19 every day, we do know the virus settles in the lungs and causes a cough and shortness of breath. And for asthmatics, that can be even more dangerous. News 19 spoke with Dr. Greg Black from Carolina Allergy and Asthma to talk about four things that folks with asthma can do today to protect their lungs before they get sick.
There's four very important things in general. Number one, compliance with your asthma regimen or adherence to your doctor's plan. Your doctor is going to tell you, here's your steroid inhaler, we want you to take this, two puffs in the morning, two puffs at night. What you normally see with people who get into trouble with asthma is that they're not taking their medicines the way that they're supposed to. The New England Journal of Medicine did a great study several years ago, and it looked at asthma fatalities. And over a 12-month period, if somebody was supposed to be filling an asthma inhaler at their pharmacy once a month, the people that died from their asthma only filled one or two of their steroid inhalers over a 12-month period. So for the people that take their asthma medicine regularly, they do a lot better, and their risk of death is very low. Number two, we want you to talk with your doctor, talk with your allergist, and know what you're sensitive to. If you're sensitive to dust, if you're sensitive to grass, be careful when being around those substances. Animal dander, you want to know if you want to stay away from that. But also avoiding known irritants like smoke, perfume, harsh chemicals, things of that nature. The third thing would be actually exercise. Exercise is good for the lungs, but this is also one of those things where there's a countermanding principle such that if your asthma is not doing very well, exercise can worsen it. But at baseline, if your asthma is doing well and your doctor says, yes, your lungs are healthy right now, your lung function is good, running, actually swimming has been proven to be one of the best exercises for asthma, something maybe a lot of your viewers aren't going to be doing right this second, obviously. And the last thing is vaccines. We mentioned the flu and the Pneumovax, but getting your annual vaccine updates. If you're 18 to 64 and you're an adult with asthma, getting a Pneumovax is very beneficial for you because it can prevent bacterial pneumonia. And, of course, staying up to date with your annual flu shot is very important as well.
Okay, and there's been a long history of racism, as I mentioned earlier, in the U.S. healthcare system. In 1896, W.E.B. Du Bois showed that black children under five were three times more likely to die than white children. And as late as 1912, only 19 of New York City's 29 hospitals would even admit black patients. And only three gave black physicians the right to tend to their patients or to perform operations. And in 1960, racial health disparities took the lives of more than 60,000 black people in the United States, this according to analyst David Satchner. By 2000, the number had reached nearly 84,000 people. Latino, Asian, and Native American communities have also been historically marginalized within the U.S. healthcare system. All of this affects the present in terms of looking at the coronavirus. A look at Medicare data, by the way, claims from between 2006 and 2012 reveal that black and Latino patients were far more likely than white patients to be sent to a hospital emergency department that was further away. Now, we have two experts on public health waiting to speak with us. I would like to welcome Dr. Chandra Ford, lead editor with a few others of Racism, Science and Tools for the Public Health Professor, and she is the founding director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health, and associate professor of Community Health Sciences at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. Dr. Chandra Ford, welcome.
Thank you.
I'd also like to welcome Dr. Bita Amani. Dr. Bita Amani is an associate professor at Charles R. Drew University at the Department of Urban Public Health. She is a socio-political epidemiologist whose public health pedagogy, research, and practice centers on larger questions of racism and social justice. With over a decade of experience in both local and global settings, her work has focused on how systems and structures determine the epidemiology of disease. So, Dr. Bita Amani, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Chandra Ford, let us start with you, because we are living in times that none of us, frankly, have lived through before. This pandemic is growing by the hour, it seems, the numbers going up. And given what I outlined also in the introduction about diseases that are prevalent in communities of color, as well as the disparities in health care, your thoughts on the impact now, how this might impact the present-day crisis we're dealing with.
I appreciate the way that you framed this segment. It's absolutely critical that we do think about the inequalities that are embedded in our society. This virus does not see color. It doesn't see race or ethnicity. It doesn't carry a passport. It doesn't stop at national borders. It takes anyone that it can. But we live in a society where those kinds of inequalities are embedded. And so if our focus on addressing the epidemic looks only at the virus with and ignores all of these other considerations, what we'll see, and this would be my concern, and it's why we're jumping in as early as we can, is that we will see disparities that persist along these different lines of inequality.
Yeah, and I'm wondering your thoughts, Dr. Bita Amani.
I mean, I'm really struck by how in the introduction you gave a historical analysis of how, you know, Du Bois mentioned how children under the age of, black children under the age of five are three times more likely to die, and you fast forward to Los Angeles County in 2020, where you have two to three times more likely death amongst black babies who are born, if not about four times more likely death for black mothers, right? And when you think about this epidemic and, or you know, this pandemic, and how already those baseline vulnerabilities exist for communities of color when it comes to comorbidities, and the roots for those being the environmental racism, the occupational racism, and you think about that clip that you showed where the expert is telling us, hey, you know, avoid these triggers. Well, those triggers that ostensibly we have the ability to avoid are triggers that these communities have not been able to avoid for a while. And it's these triggers that they have not been able to avoid, whether they're in their workplace, whether they're in their neighborhoods in terms of, like, you know, the placing of polluting centers, right where people are living, or forcing them to live in places that already there is so much pollution in the land and air. Like, these things that are, which are unavoidable, that we're being asked to avoid right now, are part of the reason why, as Dr. Ford said, we're going to continue to see disparities even after this pandemic, and call them more collateral consequences to racism if we don't get ahead of this right now.
Yes, and what I'd like to do now also is to just play this a short piece of Trump yesterday at the briefing on the coronavirus, and then get your response. Let's go to that clip now.
Why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus? There are reports of dozens of incidents of bias against Chinese Americans in this country. Your own aide, Secretary Azar, says he does not use this term. He says ethnicity does not cause the virus. Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
A lot of people say it's racist.
It's not racist at all. No, not at all. It comes from China. That's why. Comes from China. I want to be accurate. Yeah, please, John. Please. I have great love for all of the people from our country. But as you know, China tried to say at one point, maybe they stopped now, that it was caused by American soldiers. That can't happen. It's not going to happen. Not as long as I'm president. It comes from China.
Okay, so it comes from China, the Chinese virus. Dr. Chandra Ford, let us just start with you. I mean, that kind of dangerous race baiting, clearly that's what's happening now. And given the fact that I just read a report just this morning that in the Trump era, white supremacist groups in the United States alone have gone up by 55%, Dr. Chandra Ford.
That's exactly right. This is dangerous language. And there are implications for people who are Chinese, certainly. There are implications for Chinese Americans, but there are also implications for Asian Americans. And it's not just racialized against Asians. We have already seen that tweets and comments on Twitter targeting folks coming from south of the border are being racialized as these folks are bringing COVID-19 into the country. So in thinking about the ways that we have to respond, we have to realize that if we're not supporting and if we're not addressing the ways that these viruses and epidemics are racialized against one group, we'll miss the ways that it affects another. And that's something that has persisted throughout the history of the United States, is that when, and not just in the United States, but more globally, that when diseases are stigmatized and linked to certain racial or ethnic groups, that that kind of stigma can serve as a barrier to members of that group actually getting the services they need. Today, we need to be concerned about how that kind of language might affect undocumented communities, immigrant communities, whether documented or undocumented, and many other groups.
Yes, absolutely. And also, I'd like for you to weigh in on this point, Dr. Bita Amani.
The idea, as Dr. Ford said, that this is like a historical precedence of wanting to label diseases as like coming from some sort of racial other is so rooted in the, you know, the settler colonial logic of the United States. It is a part of imperial science, this idea that, you know, wherever the colonizers landed, there was always some sort of, other group of which they had to protect themselves. And so from these roots, you still see, you know, once again, in 2020, that same kind of fear-based racist language and logic at play. Getting to Dr. Ford's point here about how it then impacts, right? So on one hand, we have the comorbidities that are already present that make us vulnerable when it comes to this pandemic. And on the other hand, we have the response to it, and we have the lack of confidence we have in a response, that it'll be a racist response, that it'll use a racial logic to make already a very difficult situation much worse. This will be, like Dr. Ford said, increase like incidents of violence, right, against like people of Asian American, in this country. This will also be, you know, then part of how we maybe might not think about
let's close down the detention centers on the border, right? Kind of that anti-Latino, Latina, Latinx sentiment, right, is persistent there. Or it might even impact the ways that we will continue to keep people locked up in this country, in the jails. Like, for example, here in Los Angeles County, because an anti-Black, anti-Brown racism persists, that makes us think that we have to treat people this way because we have to protect the rest of the community from this coronavirus. So on the national level, on the global level of wanting to otherize this disease, we'll see a trickle-down effect even to the local level of thinking, okay, well, it can also be these other Black, Brown, and poor bodies that are going to carry this virus, and we need to protect ourselves from them.
Dr. Ford, also, I mean, looking at just the definition of public health, clearly this whole thing is a public health crisis. I've seen all kinds of experts on mainstream television talking about the public health crisis and what people should do. I've heard very little about how, they talk about vulnerable communities of those of us who are older and who should self-isolate, and if you have an underlying disease, you know, then you're vulnerable, but they never unpack that any further in terms of who these people are, what are some of the underlying diseases that impact, for example, communities of color. We mentioned, you know, asthma is practically at an epidemic level, particularly among young people, but I'm also hearing, people who are adults who are getting asthma as an adult who didn't have it as a child. I mean, people like myself, for example, and a few other people even at our station, the KPFK station in Los Angeles, that has happened to. So, you know, just in terms of the definition of public health itself, and also all of the daily incidences of racism and discrimination that people have to deal with, people who are Black, people who are Indigenous, people who are considered the other, and how that also impacts your health and therefore vulnerability to whatever is going on out there in terms of a virus or other illnesses. Dr. Chandra Ford, I wonder if you have some thoughts on that.
Anyone who says that they know exactly whether or not a person will be exposed to COVID-19 and whether or not they'll get sick and what the consequences would be, no one can offer an exact guidance on any specific individual with respect to that. And so I always want to point people to the resources of the CDC, which is our national public health practice body. The NIH is a national research body, and the World Health Organization and your local state governments, in terms of knowing exactly what are the conditions I need to be aware of. But what I will say is that public health as a field has done a very poor job of explaining to the public the value of what we do. And also, we have done a very poor job of addressing the racism that exists within the ways that we serve communities, the ways that we approach the work that we do. For instance, we often have a sort of white saviorism that leads us to show up in communities, tinker around with something, and think that by our presence there, we're going to resolve the issue. What I think would be more useful is to take a moment and be thoughtful about the ways that we're trying to engage communities and actually engage communities in finding solutions that can be effective and implementable in those communities, as opposed to just following this sort of eager desire to just do something, to just jump in and do something. Because sometimes those efforts can actually do harm, as opposed to doing something that's more constructive. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for Senator Kamala Harris, but she was talking about the need for communities to just trust our providers and the messages that are coming from the public health sector. Sources of mistrust in these communities come from historical experiences with racism and ongoing experiences with racism and mistrust. And so to convince people simply to doubt and deny what they already have experienced in favor of a system that has not actually reckoned with its own racism is not the strategy that I believe we as public healthers should take. Rather, we need to understand why do people mistrust the public health and medical sectors and remedy those.
And just some final comments, actually, from you, Dr. Abita Amani.
Well, I mean, you know, Chandra's point right here of reckoning, right, with the history of racism and the fact that it hasn't been reckoned with or rectified. I'm sure, you know, you've noticed that there's an eerie eugenics type of, like, undertone to this conversation that's been having.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, medical professionals, and we don't really need to get into whether they're conscious of it or not, of this, are completely, you know, going to end up being complicit in it. They're working in a system that has always maintained a state of crisis for them, right? A public health crisis has been institutionalized and made permanent in this country. And because of this, when they're in these settings where they don't have enough resources, when they will see images of ICE agents getting masks, right, while they're doing arrests, and they don't have enough masks in their own settings, they're going to think that they have to make decisions that are going to have catastrophic consequences for communities of color. They're going to start to then determine what life is more valuable, whose lives are more valuable. Already around the county, we don't have equal life expectancies. You have people being born on the west side that can live up to 15 years longer than people that are being born in south and southeast Los Angeles, right? We already have this idea that it's acceptable by race, place, and class, and gender for some people to not make it to the end because of whatever reason, right? We used to blame it on biology, then we moved to behavior, right? Never really indicting, like, the social systems. So when you think about this larger picture, you think about this kind of scarcity of resources that we're already going into, for us to think that the public is going to have confidence in the public health system when it knows that at some point we're going to have to come in and make these decisions that we've historically made not in the people's favor, having, you know, thinking about this stuff becomes even more important right now before we end up into having to, like, look back on the collateral consequences from all of this.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. But before we do, Dr. Chandra Ford, is there a website or a place people can go to get information about the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's racialhealthequity.org. That's racialhealthequity.org. We're also on Twitter at racialhealtheq. That's at racialhealtheq.
On that note, we really want to thank both of you for joining us, Dr. Chandra Ford and Dr. Bita Amani. We appreciate you sharing your expertise with us today, and we'll have you back as this crisis continues to unfold. Thank you.
Thank you for your important work.
All righty. We are going to take a short station break, and then coming up, okay, election security issues, there are plenty of them about, but how is it compounded with the coronavirus crisis? John Benifaz, co-founder and president of Free Speech for People, waiting to speak with us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. That was Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around by The Roots. Our website is www.radio.org, and our handle on Instagram and Twitter at So True Radio. We're also on SoundCloud around the nation and around the world. And today, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in that great state of Pennsylvania. And internationally, we would like to give a shout out to our listeners in New Zealand. Before we go to our election security issues, I just want to announce that the coronavirus pandemic has exposed how central caregiving is to life and survival, and how much caregivers are actually relied upon. For services that governments are not providing, but there's also no relief package for caregivers. And there's going to be a webinar, Valuing Caregiving, the Unwage Work That Protects People and the Environment. That's going to be tomorrow, Friday, the 20th. It starts at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. East Coast Time. And just do a search as webinar, Valuing Caregiving, the Unwage Work That Protects People and the Environment. You could get at Zoom and just scroll down so you can register. You can also get details at the Global Women's Strike Philadelphia Facebook page. Among the speakers are going to be the Reverend Liz Theo Harris, Joint Coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Also Selma James, many of you have heard her on these airways, founder of the International Wages for Housework campaign. I'll also be participating, so I look forward to as many of you as possible joining this key webinar. We are in lockdown. People are being asked to stay home. And guess who's taking care of the families and communities? This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And I would now like to welcome John Benefaz, co-founder and president of Free Speech for People. He previously served as the executive director and then general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute, an organization he founded in 1994, and as the legal director of Voter Action, a national election integrity organization. John Benefaz, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are doing this show a little bit differently because we are self-distancing, and so I'm reminding our audience, if you're having any sound issues, just turn the volume way up. So, John Benefaz, a lot of us are very concerned about voter suppression issues that we have seen on the increase since the Supreme Court decision that gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act. But and then there were all the claims of foreign interference into the elections. But now we also have this pandemic, and there's a lot of worry about how that is already impacting the electoral process in the United States. Just give us your thoughts on all this.
Yes. So obviously, prior to this pandemic, we had serious concerns all over the country with respect to insecure and unreliable voting systems, where electronic voting machines that have been proven to be hackable and also break down for benign reasons, causing long lines and disenfranchising people, that many states were still using these systems, despite the fact that computer scientists for many years now have demonstrated that they should be taken off the market and not be used for the process of counting votes. Now we have, with this pandemic, a whole new set of election security concerns. First, with respect to ensuring that voters can be safe in casting their votes. And so clearly there's a need for no excuse absentee voting being made available all across the country so those who want to vote by mail can do so. But it also heightens the reason why we should move all across the nation to the gold standard of hand-marked paper ballot systems, because those systems where people choose to do in-person voting, those systems are going to be far safer to use than electronic voting machines. Touchscreen devices are now vectors for spreading this disease. And in those jurisdictions where people are being asked to use those devices for voting, there's no real way to protect in a way that matches up to the Hamark paper ballot systems to protect the safety and health of the voters. When you try to sanitize the touchscreen device, you can actually impact the device itself. And it's also been shown that the use of the device with hand sanitizers on your hand is in fact going to potentially impact the device. So these devices were already unreliable prior to this pandemic, but now they're even more so unreliable and insecure with the public health crisis we now face.
I'm wondering about this because in L.A. County, I'm based in L.A. County, certainly when I went to vote, there were these new touch screen machines that you just referred to, but they also caused a great delay because everything was taking a lot longer than previously, and that is also discouraging people from voting. But there are these very real concerns that you just outlined for us, and I've read that some people are proposing that all voting be done, that people just, you mail people the ballots and they just mail it in. Like LA County and others that have spent enormous amount of money on these machines, you just outlined the dangers of using them, especially in this time of the pandemic. And I'm wondering if, as Congress are looking